The committee will come to order. Representative Corkelson, will you move the minutes from the February 3rd meeting?
Mr. Chair, I would happily move the minutes.
All right, thank you. Any questions on those? All in favor of adoption, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Minutes are adopted. All right, Representative Knuth. And members, we're going to do 15 minutes on this bill for discussion. I don't think we have any further testifiers. And then go to a vote on it so we can continue to move through the other legislation we have. So I don't know if you wanted to start out with anything, Representative, or if we can just sort of, if people have questions about the bill. All right. Seeing no questions, I think Representative Murphy will renew her motion that House File 250, is that right? Okay. As amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Environment Committee, Representative Eakins Committee. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
All right. Representative Lane. Yeah. Welcome to your committee. So, welcome to the table, Representative Lane. You'd like to you have a motion?
I'd like to move that House File 434 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register.
All right, the motion's before us. Representative Lane, proceed.
And I have an amendment, but I need to have an oral addition to the amendment. So I believe the amendment, is amendment around?
It's being distributed, and oh, the amendment's in the folder, excuse me.
Okay.
But, yeah, so, but what's your oral amendment?
The, we need to conform to what I'm striking, we need to change that heading part, and there was a piece that was left out by the reviser. So it's line 1.5, delete the semicolon, and everything after the semicolon.
Oh, okay. So it's in the header of the...
Yes, and then line 1.6, delete that, up to the period, so then that just takes care of that section.
Okay, does everybody understand what we're doing there? We're just deleting the last phrase of the header. Okay. So I think, Representative Lane, you can just incorporate that.
All right. And with that incorporated, I'd like to move that amendment.
Okay. And could you explain? It looks like the first thing is taking out Section 1 entirely.
Taking out Section 1 entirely and a wording in the very last line of Section 2.
Okay. And members, does anybody have any questions about this amendment? It did come in a little bit late, but since it's just removing a new provision, it struck me as kind of being within the author's prerogative. Okay, if everybody's okay with that, then we'll proceed. Any questions on the amendment? All right, all in favor of adopting the A0917 amendment as modified, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right, Representative Lane.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill originally contained two parts applicable to two different sections of statute, and I'd like to make a quick comment about the first part that has just been deleted. This section on the original bill, it's lines 1.8 to 1.14, represented our concerns that many pregnant women may not be receiving the information they need before they are in labor about the non-pharmacological methods of pain relief available to them during labor, and our concerns that they may not be receiving information ahead of time about the medical interventions that would be used during labor and delivery. And I recall in last year's health care bill that there was an emphasis on the use of patient aids, on requiring that patients be given the information that they need to be a part of the decisions on their care and to help them be aware so that they could choose the least costly option. So that was the focus of this first part of the bill, but I have become aware that how to achieve this end that needs further discussion and a better articulation of the process. Therefore, that is what I have stricken at this time. Now, what this bill achieves in itself is a clarification of what doula services are. In statute currently is the definition that Doula services means emotional and physical support during pregnancy, labor, birth, and postpartum. What we are seeking here in this simple modification is clarification that doulas primarily provide support to the pregnant woman during labor and delivery. And please recognize that mostly this is a service paid for by the woman herself who is seeking to have that kind of continuous support with her during labor and delivery. So the new wording is doula services means continuous emotional and physical support during labor and birth and intermittently during the prenatal and postpartum period. Please also note that as we discussed 2 years ago when we brought the original bill, that the doula provides emotional and physical support only, not medical. This is clearly and specifically left to the medical providers and is upheld by both the doula certification rules and the hospital rules. The Hospital Association has told me that they have no problem with this bill's clarification. So now I would like to turn to Susan Lane to explain the reasons why we need this clarification.
Ms. Lane.
The clarification for continuous care is simply that the continuity of care is the primary feature of the doula support. There is no other way that this is provided and no other service to provide this. So frequently it is the case in a hospital situation that there will be anywhere from 5 to 12 different caregivers coming and going throughout the course of the labor with introductions and so on and so forth. So the support is very erratic, and it depends on how many people are giving birth and what the hospital staffing ability is. This just simply offers a service to a mother where she has continuous physical and emotional support to help her with her labor. Without the continuity, it doesn't add anything.
Any Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the testifier. Hi.
Hi.
I just have one question, if you can help me understand the difference between physical support and medical support. There seems to be a gray area to me in those terms.
I think it's a language issue, just a semantic issue. Physical meaning that we do a lot of work with positioning. We support mothers physically when they want to move, literally hold them up sometimes when nurses are not available to do that, help them to be comfortable. We put maybe 20 pillows around somebody. I see the smiles from the people who've been there. So it's that sort of thing that increasingly there is not any kind of medical personnel to do, and it is really not medical work. We are always working in conjunction and actually under the supervision of a nurse when we're in a hospital because they're there in and out all the time. So it's that kind of physical support, not blood pressures, not checking cervixes or anything like that.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think the gray area for me is the difference between the physical support provided by a doula and the physical support provided by a registered nurse, which is different than the support maybe provided by a medical physician. And that's where I think the gray area lies, and I just want that part acknowledged on the record.
Sometimes it's the same in that a nurse may put pillows between a mother's legs or behind her back, and I may do that too. Again, this is generally done in partnership. And clearly, you know, we're visible. But more often than not, increasingly, there's just not that kind of time on behalf of the nurse who's doing massive amounts of charting and may have more patients than she'd intended because there's no way to predict how many women are going into labor on any given night. So maybe we have a nurse who stays the whole time. And then, but the other aspect of the doula care, in addition to the physical support that we're giving there along with the nurse, is that we also have a relationship with the mother previously and postpartum too. So it's a continuity of care in all those ways. But it's a good question. I don't think we ever are it's ever the case that we would be taking jobs from nurses. We would certainly not want that to happen. We'd love one-on-one care all the time, nursing care. Make us happy.
President Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not concerned about that.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
The addition in the language to additional organizations, they don't exist right now, but that's just so you don't have to keep coming back here to add that in.
Well, let me make comments back to that, taken out by the amendment, too. the or any additional organizations recognized by the Commissioner of Health is part of the amendment. It was stricken by request of the Health Department because that would require the Commissioner of Health to establish some standards, and time equals money, so there'd be a fiscal note.
We're taking it out. I misread it. Okay, I appreciate that. Any other questions, members? Okay. Representative Lane renews her motion that House File 434 be recommended pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is moved on.
Thank you very much.
All right. Representative Norton. And Representative Norton will move that House File 359 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for moving my House file. Members, today I'm bringing forward an important bill that admittedly is controversial from a mandate perspective, but absolutely the right thing to do with regard to policy and the treatment of young children with autism. My bill today is asking you to level the playing field for all children diagnosed with autism whose families are covered by private insurance providers in the state of Minnesota. I will recognize up front that we do not have the authority to affect self-funded plans that are affected by federal ERISA laws, but would like to note that President Obama has indicated his support of the federal autism insurance mandate, which would affect these ERISA plans. Through this bill, I'm asking that you acknowledge the health care needs of our children with autism and to put into law the language that will assure that our families have access to the medically recommended and proven early intervention treatments that our children need and deserve. I bring this bill to you because of my previous work with families of young children with disabilities. There was nothing more traumatic than facing a young couple and confirming their greatest fear, that their perfectly beautiful child and beloved child had autism. I'll never forget one mother's painful plea for help so that someday she could hear her child call her mommy. There's no cure for autism, but today we have empirical evidence for treatments that provide excellent outcomes, especially when they are begun early in the child's life, generally just after diagnosis. Mayo Clinic doctors in a recent publication said, and I quote, "Decades worth of scientific research provide clear and convincing support for the technique referred to as applied behavioral analysis, or ABA. But for many families, this intensive behavioral intervention is denied by their insurance companies. For others, the lucky ones, their insurance companies agree to this treatment. This bill will level the playing field for all families, making ABA and other therapies available for them all. For the record, the American Academy of Pediatrics Journal stated that about 6.5 to 6.6 in 1,000 children are believed to have one of the autism spectrum disorders. They state the primary goal for treatment is to minimize the core features and associated deficits of autism to maximize functional behavior and optimize medical care that is most likely to have a positive impact on habilitative progress and quality of life. Other studies, one done in Texas, believe that cost savings throughout a person's lifetime can be found with the use of ABA early intervention therapies for the vast majority of children with autism. We know from research that children who receive appropriate treatment, ABA, speech therapy, and other proven treatments, are able to be mainstreamed into classes, and some even go to college with some assistance and lead productive lives. This is a far cry from what I learned back in college on autism, when we saw films of institutionalized children who were unable to communicate effectively, were spinning, banging their heads, and doing other self-stimulation behaviors. They were unable to be mainstreamed effectively into our schools or society. Fortunately, those days are behind us. I would like you to hear from those that have come today to share their views. We'll try to keep their stories short so that you can hear from a number of them, and then I know there'll be some others who will share concerns over adding a new mandate. I am committed to working with the insurers on some potential language changes between this committee hearing and Commerce, where I believe we'll be visiting next. But we will continue to ask for the same coverage that Arizona and 11 other states have rightly sought and passed. Mr. Chair, could we bring our testifiers?
Absolutely.
Down, Kristen.
Ms. Goldfig, is that right? Okay.
passes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kristen Weber Salzvig, district-wide autism teacher in School District 622 at Tartan High School. Thank you for the honor and privilege to speak before you today on behalf of HF 359. Autism incident rates are continuing to rise, as most recent research is predicting 1 in 88 children will be diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders from a current rate of 1 in 150. Research has also shown that early diagnosis and early intervention is crucial to teaching and remediating much-needed social and communication deficits. I work with students on the autism spectrum, some whom have had the benefit of early intervention supports in place. As we move these students into their communities and the adult world, their potential for more successful outcomes is much higher than those who have not had the benefit of behavioral support. Without meaningful behavioral interventions and supports in place, we increase the risk of sending young adults with autism into the community without skills to live independently or to communicate with others or to obtain meaningful employment, maintain socially and legally appropriate behaviors, and most important, become strong self-advocates for themselves. Behavioral interventions allow for the tightly closed world of children and youth with autism to open, expand, and give them the best chance to become self-sufficient and functioning members of our communities across our state. For those students who have not had access to behavioral interventions, their worlds could remain closed for their lifetime. Please picture my students who feel the world is closed to them. They cannot imagine themselves living independently, find meaningful employment, even let alone applying or interviewing for a job. Or picture a young man on my caseload who misinterprets others' social cues so inappropriately that he resorts to antisocial behaviors, including self-injury and illegal behaviors such as stalking and verbal and physical threats against others. Unfortunately for these kids, the law is blind to these disabling autism-related behaviors. And I'm going to repeat that. The law is blind to these disabling autism-related behaviors. And for adults on the autism spectrum, these behaviors could potentially be prosecuted without regard to the significant social impairments of autism spectrum disorders. This is a profoundly sad potential outcome for anyone who has not had behavioral support in place. Behavioral therapies and interventions are crucial to those afflicted with autism spectrum disorders, are crucial for early childhood development, crucial as these kids move through our school systems, where social norms expect so much of them, and especially crucial as we send these kids out into the adult world. Your support of this bill will improve outcomes for those with autism spectrum disorders, especially for the young men and women I have the privilege to work with every day and those across our state. Please give careful consideration to this bill and to the many children, youth, young adults, families, and communities that will benefit in a direct and positive way. Thank you for your consideration. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you today as an advocate for autism.
Any questions? Thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
Ms. Dawson.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Amy Dawson. My husband and I have twins, Malcolm and Eleanor. Here they are. One of them has autism, which means that one of them can rely on private insurance coverage for medically necessary care, and one of them cannot. We are not here today to ask you for a new insurance mandate. We are here today to ask you for your help, because some state-regulated insurance companies are not following existing state law. Minnesota has mental health parity and even a definition of medical necessity in the context of mental health. yet the state's attorney general had to sue the state's largest issuer of health insurance policies so that kids who have autism could obtain coverage for ABA therapy, applied behavior analysis. Since then, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota has covered ABA therapy, which is medically necessary, clinically effective, evidence-based, and cost-effective. ABA has other names, and in the context of early childhood intervention is often called Early Intensive Behavior Intervention, or EIBI. Medica and Health Partners do not cover ABA therapy. I've provided you with Medica's current policy that clearly states they do not cover intensive behavior therapy, early intensive behavior therapy, or LOVOS therapy. To be clear, this policy means that Medica does not cover the model of ABA therapy that has been proven to be clinically effective as well as cost effective. The march of time, indeed the march of science, has robbed the insurance industry of its historical arguments against ABA therapy. They can't win if they argue that ABA is experimental or not medically necessary. So now they argue that they already cover it, and that they are just concerned with ensuring that therapy is high quality. Well, they can meet that goal through provider qualification standards. So what is the truth? Why won't insurance companies cover ABA therapy or EIBI? Is it the fact that it has a large upfront cost? I think it goes beyond that. I think the problem is historical discrimination against individuals who have disabilities. Kids who have autism are treated as second-class citizens. We don't allow insurance companies to discriminate on the basis of race, color, or gender. And this is no different. This is a civil rights issue. My son is getting ABA therapy and is doing extremely well. ABA, EIBI, intensive behavior therapy, whatever you choose to call it, is an option that kids should have, and it should be covered by private insurance. That's why we're here today. Please end the discrimination. Please end willful noncompliance with state law. Please support House File 359 and work to support its passage this year. Thank you.
President Gallo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the testifier, Ms. Dawson. I don't notice anywhere in your testimony, I didn't hear it mentioned, are you a registered lobbyist?
I am, yes. I lobby exclusively on this issue, autism, because the law requires that if you spend a certain amount of time or have clients, that you do that. I'm also a parent of a kid who has autism.
Yes. No, and I appreciate that. I just think in the interest of full disclosure, you're specifically a lobbyist for some providers of autism, services for autistic people, correct?
That's correct.
Could you name those two entities?
Sure. They are Partners in Excellence and the LOVOS Institute. Okay. And they both provide ABA therapy to kids who have autism. And just so the record is clear, I view myself as a temporary lobbyist. I'm hoping that once we get this passed, there won't really be any need for me to be over here, and I can focus on my estate planning practice.
Okay, well, I think that's important to keep in the context when we're providing testimony here before the committee, okay?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Okay. Julie, Representative Buck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up question. In terms of this discussion or debate with Medica and other providers who are plans or insurers who indicate they say they cover it, but in your view don't cover ABA therapy, would they say, but they can probably speak themselves later, but do they say they don't cover ABA or EIBI therapy, or do they say they don't cover certain providers of that therapy?
As far as I know, Medica and Health Partners do not authorize coverage for any of the therapy providers who provide ABA in the context of intensive just ABA therapy.
Representative Bunn.
Then to the author or to yourself, thank you. In terms of the bill, it talks about this will cover medically necessary, and that's consistent with the phrase in 1.18's generally accepted practice parameters as determined by physicians and licensed psychologists. In your view or the authors in terms of research in this area, is ABA considered a generally accepted practice parameter determined by physicians or licensed psychologists?
Absolutely it is. And I, excuse me, I mentioned
Mayo Clinic. Dr. Barbarisi is renowned for his research, and this is one of the very few types of treatment that he says there's absolute evidence that this is the best and has evidence to prove it. And I have that research, Representative Bunn, that I'd be happy to get with you. I didn't bring it today, but I do have it in my office.
A follow-up question to that, then, in terms of the AG's office and what Blue Cross Blue Shield currently does, was that a specific issue raised in that dispute? And specifically, has Blue Cross Blue Shield now agreed to cover ABA or CIBI therapy?
Ms. Dawson.
My understanding that it was that the lawsuit involved a few different issues, and I think that at least in the beginning, one primary focus was eating disorders, so mental health coverage.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a lot of information about it, actually, at the Autism Speaks website. If you go to the autismvotes.org site, you can see a copy of the settlement and also a copy of Blue Cross Blue Shield's policy to cover therapies related to autism, including EIBI or ABA. Also, if I could add to Representative Norton's answer to your previous question, in addition to Mayo Clinic, the University of Minnesota views it as evidence-based. The U.S. Surgeon General, the American Academy of Pediatricians, the National Institute of Mental Health, the U.S. Bureau of Maternal and Child Health Care, and the list goes on. There's over 1,000 studies validating it, or concerning it.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a little bit different question for either of you to comment on. I wondered about the consistency between the language in 2.9 through 2.10 and the language in 1.18 and 1.19. The last that I mentioned, the first in the bill defines what medically necessary as that generally accepted practice parameters determined by physician or licensed psychologist. On the lines in 2.9, it talks about what health plans are required to cover. And 2.9, it just says treatment plan prescribed by insured treating physician, and then it says or mental health professional. It doesn't say licensed, you know, the language doesn't quite seem consistent across the two, that there may be a whole variety of mental health professionals, but they might just not be licensed psychologists. So I just raised it for the author is kind of an issue that struck me. It's not, yeah.
And I'll look into that, but if you look, Mr. Chair, on 2.4, it does have a definition of mental health professional that's referenced in another part of law, and so that would be the definition that would be used.
Well, I just, if that is true, and if that definition is larger, a larger group of people than licensed psychologists, I just thought there might be some problem with the bill. That's a stumbling block.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm a co-author on the bill, and just, you know, where I said I'm coming from. And the reason I co-author bills like this in general is that I think that sometimes in the long run we save money by being innovative and getting these problems early. My question is not just, I don't want you to give me the details of what treatment looks like, but as I talk to the different people in the hallways who are concerned about mandates, from the plans and so on, in this particular treatment, which I don't understand, and I don't want to know the details of, but just tell me, Ms. Dawson, since probably you're the technical person here, what they told me was they're concerned because the treatments are not varied by individual, as they understand it, and that they're open-ended and there's not good research on the outcomes. Can you, I'll say that later, but I just, while you're here, could you just comment about that? I don't know the answer to the question, but could you enlighten me?
Sure. Thank you.
Ms. Dawson.
Mr. Chairman. My son is getting ABA therapy right now, and I can tell you it is incredibly individually tailored to his needs. He's got a team of therapists who work really hard to make sure that he is making progress as fast as he can, and it's been really neat because you watch him make developmental progress. He's got a twin sister, and it's like he's in fast forward trying to catch up with her. And not just every week, but every day, they are tweaking his program to make sure that it is individually tailored. With regard to outcomes, I have plenty of studies available if people are interested and can provide them to the committee.
And Representative,
one more question. And thank you. And is there a time that he'll be done with this? Is this a finite, like a, and just how long does it take? And
yeah,
the average course.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. You know, and if they, the younger these kids start, the shorter the time period they usually need. So, for example, one of my clients, Partners in Excellence, has some terrific outcome data, and their average length of stay for a two-year-old is 2.2 years, and 89% of those kids achieve best outcomes. Best outcomes is the goal of ABA therapy. It's defined as having a typical IQ, no longer meeting the diagnostic criteria for autism, and not needing any supports or services in school. My son started when he was 4, and by the time he's 8, we think he'll be done with everything.
Mr. Chair, could I also add to that? Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I do think, and I mentioned this earlier in my testimony, the sooner, and as soon after diagnosis as you can begin treatment, the better your outcomes are. And the average, as was stated, is 2.2 years. And it does show also that the later the child gets in that same period of time, the less success you have. So it is definitely time limited. And part of the rationale and the reason I feel so passionately about this is because we need to reach these children early, provide the appropriate evidence-based treatment so that we don't have the expenses and the institutional care and the long-range intensive care that we've been seeing for the last 50 years. It's time to move beyond that, get help early, intensive help early, and then, you know, as we, you know, have said, get into classrooms and be mainstream.
One more question. And Ms. Dawson, since you're living in this world, and I appreciate the challenges with that you must face with your child, but are there better providers and poorer providers? I presume there's a bell curve, but is there some, you probably know your two groups the best, but is there some groups that don't do as good a work with this thing?
You know,
being covered by the bill.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I really am not familiar with outcome data from any place other than the Lobos Institute and Partners in Excellence, and they both have terrific outcome data. The empirical studies show 48% of kids achieve best outcomes, but for kids who don't achieve best outcomes, the difference in their quality of life is often immeasurable. If you have a kid who doesn't bang her head on the wall until she is blind, that is an immeasurable difference in quality of life. My son couldn't talk a year and a half ago when we started ABA therapy, and today he told me he wanted to make some books about dinosaurs today. He can lead our family grace at the dinner table, and he can sit through an hour-long mass better than a lot of his typical peers, as long as he gets a Nintendo Wii afterwards.
That sounds familiar. Resident member.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dawson, I suppose Representative Norton. I got three questions. The first one is, I've been getting all these emails about please cover autism, treatment of autism, suggesting that we don't, that our state-regulated insurance companies don't already provide coverage, but as I read the material and listen, that's not exactly the case. It appears that they just don't cover enough, according to what you're telling us. Well, that's the first one. Do I understand that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I think that the answer you get will depend on who you ask. I can tell you families that I talk to tell me they have been turned down for the ABA therapy, the empirically proved therapy. Other people will tell you everyone's covered. So it depends on who you ask.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Norton or Ms. Dawson, I mean, I'm asking you, and what I'm asking is, do I understand what you're telling us today, which is, and I've heard something. Now, some will tell you it's covered. Well, I've got stuff here that says under your policy you can get treatment for an autistic condition or diagnosis within the spectrum of disorders. But is it simply the ABA therapy and the EIBI therapy that you're talking about, or does it go beyond that?
Typically, if you look at the policies, you'll see an hour limit on therapy that's provided
throughout the week. So it is true that these insurance companies cover some type of therapy for autism. In contrast, a lot of the self-insured plans don't cover anything for developmental disabilities or autism, and that's an entirely different problem. The real problem here that we're trying to address is that they don't cover the proven intensive, effective behavior therapy that's often called ABA or EIBI.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Dawson. That was my understanding, that that's what you're telling us today, is that those intensive therapies are being regularly denied coverage.
Basically. Right.
I have a question following up on that. When you look at your definition of autism spectrum disorders, you throw in number 3 at line 1.13 of pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified. You know, I'm no expert. I have some knowledge, personal knowledge of the of autism and the diagnosis and the range. But isn't it true that, I mean, autism, there is a, when you say a spectrum, there is an incredible spectrum of disorders that when they can't be identified as anything else, they get they regularly get diagnosed as a form of autism. Isn't that true?
Either one?
Mr. Chairman, actually, we've got a neuropsychologist from the University of Minnesota here today, and she's scheduled to testify next, Dr. Okay. Robin Rumsey. I think she'd be perfect to answer that question.
I'll wait. That's wonderful. Then the last one, Mr. Chair. You've got on the line that Representative Bunn was asking you about the insured physician, treating physician, or mental health professional. Is there some significance there that we're including a mental health professional, or has that always been included?
Ms. Dawson.
Mr. Chairman, mental health professionals are typically the ones who evaluate children and develop the individual treatment plan for behavior therapy. So right now, my understanding is it has to be a licensed psychologist, and what this would do is help expand who could do that to the entire definition of mental health professional in the Children's Mental Health Act.
Mr. Chair?
Remember.
Wouldn't that be rather significant, and why? Why are we doing that?
Ms. Dawson.
Mr. Chairman, there's a huge backlog of kids waiting for services, and my understanding is there's something like 7 licensed psychologists who know how to develop and write individual treatment plans for early intensive behavior intervention. So if we use that definition of mental health professional, it expands very slightly the number of people who can do that and help kids get access to therapy sooner.
I'll wait for the rest of the testifiers, but Ms. Dawson, in reading your letter, you suggested that this would not, now you're telling me there's this backlog, maybe I misunderstood, but I thought it said in here that this would not expand it greatly, you know, this mandated coverage would not create a whole, it wouldn't impact that many people, am I wrong?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, it doesn't affect that many people in terms of policyholders, because there's only about 28% of the market that's state regulated, and most of that actually, well, I think 36%, I provided you with some statistics from the Department of Health, is Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, so those policies already cover it. So as a percentage of the market, we're talking about changing it for a small percentage of the market. But one of the problems we have in Minnesota, we have a problem with, first of all, getting an evaluation. For our son, we waited 8 months from the time we put him on wait list to get a thorough evaluation for a diagnosis, and then we waited another, 5 to 6 months to get him into treatment.
And Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, but this is not just with respect to this. A pediatric neuropsychologist, you're going to wait 4 to 5 months to get into as well. I mean, it just happens to be when you're looking for these qualified, more specialized professionals, there are fewer of them as you keep going up the chain. So I'm interested to hear more about why you'd want to expand that, and I'll look forward to listening to the others. Thanks for answering the question.
And Representative Norton, you had something you wanted to say to one of the questions along the way.
Well, I just had a couple points to make to Representative Emmer's comments. Currently, we are treating many children with autism not with the best practice, not with the evidence-based treatment, because of the way our law is written and the lack of equity. So we are paying for treatment for some children, but they're not getting the kind of treatment that they need and deserve. They may be getting other treatments, and it's not a one-size-fits-all. So we can't write a law that says you only get ABA. ABA, according to Dr. Barbarici, works for 70% of children with autism that get the early intervention. We need to have other options, speech therapy, occupational therapy, all those other wonderful treatments that children with autism need. So I wanted to point that out. We are paying for it. We're just not always, parents are desperate to get help, so they're taking whatever is available, but it's not always the best thing. So let's pay for the best thing short term, those 2.2 years, and then have them mainstreamed into the schools and have less care for the long run. I also wanted to just mention the thrown in pervasive developmental disorder. PDD is probably the first diagnosis in my experience that children were getting when they were birth to three, which is the area I worked with, young children being diagnosed the first time. PDD was, and I hate to say, sometimes I think the physicians were a little nervous about saying your child has autism. So pervasive developmental disorder is under the purview of the autism spectrum disorders, and that's often what is given very first. And hopefully we're getting a little better about that over time. And as you mentioned, we have broadened the definition several years ago of autism spectrum disorders, which includes Asperger's and many other variations.
To kind of, on that, the earlier point, if a child is six, or I don't know what the age would be, where ABA therapy wouldn't work, would that have to be covered under this bill?
Well, actually, there's probably no age at which ABA therapy categorically wouldn't work, but the only ages at which it's meant to be and is delivered in an intensive, high number of weekly hours model, and Dr. Rumsey can correct me if I make a mistake here, is in the early childhood years. But certainly older kids can benefit from it, but it's just not easily delivered to them in an intensive model. It would be required to be covered, yes.
Okay.
And if I may follow up, I think, you know, I assume when people talk and say things that there's some grain of truth in what they say. And the only one thing that I thought is that maybe the insurance companies are saying they cover ABA therapy because some of the therapy providers they do cover who provide a combination of different modalities, you know, probably incorporate a little bit of ABA in what they do.
Representative Fun? And, you know, we need to get through the kind of pro-testifiers, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 more people in about 12 minutes here. So,
Just to really understand more clearly, first of all, I want to say this is such an important topic.
And I just say that because we're going to probably answer many people's questions with other testifiers.
Okay.
So,
well, then you can tell me if you're going to answer this another one. Well, first of all, it's very important, so thank you for being here. And secondly, this issue of who covers it now and how do they cover it and to what extent it is covered. Before this gets you through all the committees this session, I think those questions need to be answered, whether we can answer them all here today, whether all state employees receive this coverage, even those that are not on Blue Cross Blue Shield but through the other plans, all those, whether MIA patients are through TEFR or some other mechanism, and how much, you know, equality do we have across these categories, to what extent the self-insured do it or not do it. As much as possible about that kind of information. Secondly, in terms of prior to school age, when you receive this intensive therapy, when you said it could last two and a half, 3 years in the 2 to 5 year old range, are we talking 5 days a week, X number of hours a day? Could you give us just some sense of how intensive we're talking about, and are you expecting that medical insurance or health care insurance would pay for all of those hours?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I can talk about the therapy my son is getting. He's getting an average of 36 hours a week of direct face-to-face therapy. In addition, there's 1 hour of time that's a clinical review meeting that my husband and I go to, although my husband sometimes misses it due to work. I hate meetings, but this is the most important meeting, and on a weekly basis, it is the most important meeting I ever have. We and I'll leave it at that. I also get 3 hours a week of parent training so that I can help implement these techniques and help make sure that he's getting the right kind of behavior therapy 24/7. My husband right now is also getting another hour and a half as part of a study, so insurance isn't covering that. But in addition to those direct service hours, it's actually a whole team of people managing this therapy, and the overall person hours is often 50 to 60 hours. But I also want you to know that the intensity, it kind of eases in the beginning. In the first couple of months, it wasn't that many hours, but it has been since probably month three. Next year, he's going to go to kindergarten with a behavior therapist to shadow him, to prompt him to participate in school and follow the rules and everything. And in the afternoon, he'll probably most days, he'll get some individual skills training. And then the following year, he's actually going to repeat kindergarten. And the idea is that he'll need less of that, and we don't know how much. And that whole plan is, you know, subject to change.
Mr. Speaker, if I could just supplement. With my experience with First to Three, often there's a shared responsibility between the insurance and the school districts for those that can get some insurance help or personal pay in school districts. The school districts have now started coming on board and making that part of what they're offering in some instances. So I think there's a shared responsibility there as well. School districts also, probably 10 or 15 years ago, were allowed to bill insurance companies for the services that they provide in the classrooms, and that may impact as well what the insurers pay. Not everyone does that.
Thank you. Just a quick comment in terms of what's going on in my head about some of this is that in those years, you know, 2 to 5, most parents are paying, if they're working parents, are paying, you know, $12,000-$14,000 a year for child care in some cases for their kid, you know, a large amount of money, or, you know, 8 to 12, whatever. And it strikes me that this is basically full-time, you know, daytime care as well, and yet it would all be potentially billed to insurance under this versus, I'm not saying they're the same thing at all, I'm not saying that at all, I'm just saying that these families would be foregoing a normal cost that they would be incurring during those years, possibly, you know, without an autistic child diagnosis, that is now being partly offset by this. And just, you don't have to respond to that. I'm just saying there's all kinds of different thoughts about this that that the insurance companies may be taking into account when they think about
this. Mr. Chairman, very quickly, I would like to respond to that. You know, you have home-based ABA therapy or center-based ABA therapy. My kid's getting home-based ABA therapy, so in addition to the therapy, he needs to have somebody at home. So in addition to the therapy costs, there are daycare or nanny costs associated with it as well. And since I've got twins, I can tell you it's a ton of money.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Dawson. Dr. Rumsey. Welcome to the committee.
So I'm a pediatric neuropsychologist and I'm Robin Rumsey. I'm a pediatric neuropsychologist and a licensed psychologist at the University of Minnesota.
Please go with your testimony.
I work in the Autism Spectrum Disorders Program and am a member of an interdisciplinary team that conducts comprehensive evaluations for possible autism spectrum disorder. And I also follow a number of the children we have diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder over time in order to monitor their developmental progress and their response to intervention. We, as part of our clinic, very regularly recommend early intensive behavior intervention, also called applied behavior analysis or ABA therapy, for the children we diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. We know it to be an evidence-based intervention based both on the literature and firsthand, on the tremendous progress a number of our children have made. ABA therapy helps young children form neural connections in the brain that would not otherwise be formed because of self-imposed social isolation. We do not recommend ABA therapy for every child who comes through our clinic. We often make this recommendation for young children with ASD, usually under age 5, preferably younger, who have significant socialization and communication challenges, who just can't learn in a typical preschool classroom. The ultimate goal of ABA is to integrate children with autism with typical peers in a typical setting. This means they will have an average or higher IQ and be successful in a typical setting with minimal or no additional support. And research has shown that about a third to a half of children who receive this EIDI intervention or EIDI achieve this best outcome. Those children who do not make enough gains to be mainstreamed in a typical classroom, and as Ms. Dawson mentioned too, still can receive significant benefits and greatly improve their quality of life. What we have seen is 30 to 40 hours of one-to-one intervention for at least 2 years may be required to produce the maximum effect, and parent involvement is also necessary for maximum effect. At the University of Minnesota, we try to connect children and families with established and evidence-based interventions. And ABA therapy is one of the therapies for children with autism spectrum disorders that actually has the most evidence-based. What is so frustrating for us is that families receive what is basically a devastating diagnosis. There's a therapy out there that has been shown to be effective. We recommend this therapy, and then the parents can't access it. We have parents who cannot afford the monthly payments for TEFRA or MCHA, or who are so overwhelmed by the application process for funding that they don't follow through. The application process itself has been known to take several months, a loss of several months of therapy. We also have parents who have put second and third mortgages on their homes in order to pay for the therapy services out of pocket. Last year, we recommended ABA therapy to two very savvy families who are employed at the University of Minnesota, and their private University of Minnesota insurance would not cover the services. And so these families appealed. We supported these families in the appeals process, met with employee benefits, provided evidence for the therapy and ideas for monitoring the children's response to intervention, and they ultimately made the decision to cover the therapy. We are very proud of this accomplishment, as it has opened the door for a few more families to receive the benefits of ABA therapy without a fight. Should private insurances be required to cover ABA therapy, many more children would be served. They would be served at younger ages, leading to even better outcomes. Families would be less stressed, and ultimately there would be a decrease in cost of care over the child's lifetime. Thank you.
Questions, members?
Yeah, right.
Oh, Representative Huntley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Rumsey, I'm interested in the number of groups. I know Representative Norton mentioned some that support this. I'm big on evidence-based medicine, but I haven't read this report. So if you could give just rehash what the groups that support it and the evidence for it.
Well, I brought a couple of articles with me. These are meta-analyses, which is the highest form of analysis. So meta-analyses take all the individual studies that are out there on ABA therapy. They rank them based on the standards and the research qualities of each of the in particular studies. So are they randomly assigned? You know, what are the characteristics of each of the studies? And a recent publication here has reviewed studies for TEACH, which is a classroom-based program, the Colorado Health Sciences Project, and ABA therapy. And of the three, they noted that ABA therapy was the only one that is considered well-established. And well-established is defined as, or requires treatment manuals and clearly specified subject groups and either two independent well-designed group studies showing the treatment to be better than placebo or alternative treatment or equivalent to an established effective treatment, or 9 or more single study subject design studies using strong designs in comparison to an alternative treatment. So of the studies that were reviewed, I can go through very quickly here. One showed that the treatment group gained an average of 31 points. One showed that the ABA treatment group gained an average of 25 IQ points, and 6 of the 21 ABA-treated children were fully included into a regular education without assistance, and 11 others were included with support. One showed ABA treatment group gained an average of 12 IQ points. Here's another one, 31 IQ points, and 47% of the children in the ABA group achieved average post-treatment scores and were succeeding in regular education classrooms. Here's one, treatment group gained 8.2 IQ points. Here's one, 25 IQ points, and 48% were in regular ed. 29.6 IQ points. There's a lot of evidence.
And the medicine, Mr. Chair and Dr. Runze, the medicines that are referred to here, I assume, does not include food supplements and special diets, which we used to hear a lot about autism and that, but I don't think any of those have been shown to do anything.
First of all, Representative Norton, are they included in the legislation?
They're not listed individually, and it's stated as medically recommended. And so, yes, you're correct in that research has been showing, and I have constituents who believe otherwise, and I will say that right up front. There are those who like nutritional supplements and other types of therapies, including sensory therapy, which, again, the evidence does not show significant and long-standing results.
But under the language, it arguably could be if a physician recommended it and it was shown to be within practice parameters under this legislation.
If the doctor recommended it, it would be covered, and then I guess it would be up to someone to ask for the evidence.
Right.
And could I read for the record that if Representative Huntley wasn't here earlier, it was the U.S. Surgeon General, the American Academy of Pediatricians, National Institute of Mental Health, U.S. Bureau of Maternal and Child Health Care, University of Minnesota's Autism Clinic, Mayo Clinic, and articles in Pediatrics and the Children's Journal of Family Studies, and there's one other journal that Mayo's published in. I don't know the name of it, but I can get all those for Representative Huntley. Yeah.
And the physician from Mayo that testified, this is for Representative Norton, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, did he recommend this particular treatment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, yes, he did.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Rumsey, you're reading from a report. Does it break out in those treatment groups, does it break out the specific autistic disorder, the diagnosis?
In some it does and in some it doesn't. But, I mean, this is an intervention that's primarily targeted for preschool age children.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Dr. Rumsey, but the issue is you're going to have, depending on the treatment and the program, different outcomes depending on the nature of the specific disorder, isn't
mm-hmm.
that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Rumsey.
Yes, so some of the studies, it was a prerequisite that children were verbal before they started, and in others they had some very, very severe children and they didn't select based on pre-existing conditions, and kids were randomly assigned to different groups. So the studies are weighted differently depending on whether or not that they pre-selected or had random selection. I'm happy to provide this to
Mr. Chair and Dr. Rumsey. I would like that, and I'd like to see if you've got some information that shows the spectrum that we're talking about. I mean, maybe you could tell us, is there even a quantifiable number within the spectrum, or is it just a patient presents with certain symptoms or...
Dr. Rumsey.
In our clinical experience, if a child can learn in a preschool classroom, then that's where they should be.
So this is, these therapies are more for children who don't have the communication and social interaction skills to function in a classroom, you know, with minimal support. Does that answer your question?
No, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Rumsey, it doesn't, but it's very helpful.
Okay.
I asked if there's even a quantifiable number, because what you just told me, it isn't in the legislation. It wouldn't restrict it to kids who are unable to succeed in a preschool classroom.
Mm-hmm.
It's much broader than that. And I was asking, can you even give me a quantifiable number of the identified or accepted autistic disorders, you know, within the spectrum, or is it just based on how a patient presents?
Dr. Rumsey.
There's no quantifiable number. We base it on clinical judgment as to whether the specific child, based on their pattern of strengths and weaknesses, would benefit from such an intervention. And as I said before, we do not recommend this for every child. Even if they are 4 or 5 or 3 and they come through our clinic, it's only those children who have relatively severe communication and social interaction difficulties.
Thank you, Dr. Rumsey. We need to move on here. The Kandaswamy family. And if Ms. Hendricks wants to kind of make her way down too, so we can keep moving. We are running short on time, I apologize, but we need to, if you could, to the extent possible, condense your remarks. Thank you.
I will try. I'm Beth Kandaswamy, and this is my husband, Dr. Raza Kandaswamy. Paul Stark, when our daughter was 3.5, we received the devastating news that she had autism. Her developmental pediatrician and neuropsych at the University of Minnesota Autism Spectrum Disorder Clinic described early intensive behavioral therapy as being medically necessary for her to overcome her condition. My husband and I, being researchers ourselves, felt that this was the only treatment for us since it had the research to support its effectiveness and the data and documentation to support its outcomes. At the clinic also, they also told us that we would need to get Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance, since that was the only insurance that covered this intensive behavioral therapy. So we did check into Medica. We called. They administer the University of Minnesota self-insured plan to find out about ABA coverage, intensive ABA coverage. It was quite surprising to hear from the representative over the phone that they would not cover Nina's prescribed medically necessary therapy because it was experimental and listed as exclusionary in the University of Minnesota's benefit medical summary. The representative also proceeded to tell me what I should do for her treatment, which was something that was not advised to us by her doctor. It was truly surprising to us that the university would not cover her ABA for a variety of reasons. First, the University of Minnesota's own doctors prescribed the therapy, and they also stated that it was medically necessary, which should never be an excluded benefit. Thirdly, this benefit was covered for the University of Minnesota's residents because they had the option of having Blue Cross Blue Shield. Fourthly, the University of Minnesota taught courses on this type of treatment and was receiving tuition money for training behavioral therapists through their intern program set up with the very same provider that we wanted to use. Also, the University of Minnesota had a behavioral therapy certificate program so their therapists could even get credentialed. And lastly, you know, allowing us to do therapy would save them money because it would allow her to lead an independent life instead of remaining a disabled dependent on our insurance requiring lifelong services. So since getting Blue Cross Blue Shield was not an option for us, we are forced to sign up for medical assistance. This was not a good option because our parental fee was so high that it was not something that we could afford unless we made some radical changes in our life, like selling our home. When we discovered that we could use MTA, which Medica administers, We thought this was a good option too, but they again, you know, had a 6-month waiting period due to pre-existing conditions. But also, it seems ridiculous that we would have to rely on taxpayer dollars when there is not a good reason for our own insurance to cover this. So we went through the standard appeal process, starting with Medica, and the only reason they gave us for not covering the therapy was that our employer chose not to cover this treatment, although they conveniently forgot to mention that they advised them not to cover it. So when we got to the final appeal with the University of Minnesota's Benefits Committee, they reviewed our appeal information and then again met with, you know, their experts in the field at their own clinic and decided to not only retroactively cover our daughter's treatment, but to take it off the exclusionary list and have it as a covered benefit for all University of Minnesota staff. When I asked them what made them decide to cover the therapy, they said that Medicare representatives were the ones who advised them not to cover it in the first place, and after reviewing our appeal and meeting with Medicare again, Medicare could not give them a good enough reason not to cover it. When I spoke on the phone to former Attorney General Mike Hatch, he could not believe that insurance companies were still using the word experimental and this treatment was still being excluded. This has proven not to be the case in Blue Cross Blue Shield, was mandated to cover it during his time in office, so that is why it is the only carrier who does cover it. Medicare and Health Partners were supposed to follow suit, but as evidenced by the information I have shared with you, they are clearly not. I cannot understand how insurance companies are able to refuse to cover this very treatable condition. Our daughter, when she was diagnosed at 3.5, was close to 2 years behind developmentally. Now, after not even a year and a half of therapy, she is closing that gap to 6 months delayed. She is on track to be best outcome, which means that she could start and complete first grade independently, lose her diagnosis, and not require any services to the school or from a behavioral provider. Without this therapy, that would have been nearly impossible. Someone asked me what this means to me. Well, it means everything. And I can't explain it to you because it is something that we live with every day of every minute, and we are working so intensely hard. But to have a chance to hope for a real life for your child is the most important thing in the world to us, to our family. I am so thankful that the University of Minnesota Benefits Committee made the right decision to cover her treatment. It makes me feel incredibly sad to know that the majority of children and families will not have the same outcome as us because they do not have coverage. This condition left improperly treated, that includes getting an hour or two of ABA to the school or through another type of therapy, it is not the same as 40 hours. You know, and it is not only causing an enormous burden on families, but also creating a situation of lifelong dependency, of expensive services, which will eventually all come from taxpayer dollars.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, members? Thank you very much for coming down. Appreciate it. Thank you. Ms. Hendricks.
Hi, my name is Shelley Hendricks, and I work for Autism Speaks. I'm their National Director of State-Based Advocacy, and I live in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. This is my first time in Minnesota, and I can't think of a better reason to come up here today and have the opportunity to speak in front of you all. I know that you know a lot about autism, and I just wanted to run through something really quickly while you're thinking about this and how this impacts you and the people that you represent. 1 out of 150 children in your district, minimum, are diagnosed with autism. 1 out of 94 boys who are in your district are diagnosed with autism, and 1 out of 68 families in your district are dealing with autism today. Each one of those children, if not treated properly, will, on average, cost society beyond what the parents expend to pay for their treatments and therapies and care throughout their lives. It will cost society $3.2 million. It's one of the fastest-growing developmental disabilities, and it really significantly impacts families. I have a little boy who is not little anymore. He's 13. He was initially diagnosed at the age of 2, and his prognosis was incredibly grim. And the advice that they gave us was to put him on Prozac and to start looking for an institution, because by the time he was 5, we wouldn't be able to control him or have him in our home. And he is now 13 years old. He has a girlfriend. He goes to school in a regular classroom all day long. And most recently, he has not completely recovered, but he's doing really, really well. And he has a lot of typical behaviors. And most recently, just 2 days ago, he asked me to go get a Valentine's Day present for his girlfriend and also pick up some Axe body spray at Walmart so that he would smell nice. So I see that as a very good sign. I wanted to point out, because I'm sure that when the insurance companies come forward, they'll address the costs associated with a provision like this. And I just want to let you know that that's one of the things that there's not a lot of answers that we have with regard to autism. We're not really sure what causes it. But one of the things that's been asked and answered over and over again in a number of states around the country that I've been working with is how much this would impact policies. And over again in the actuarial studies that have been done, whether they've been done by a mom and a dad that are advocates that somehow figured out how to do the math, or an actual actuary that's done the study, or even the industry themselves through the Council for Affordable Healthcare, it's always less than 1% impact, and it's usually 0.5%. And for a dollar amount, that translates to about a little less than $2 per month. So for a little less than $25 a year, investment in helping these children succeed, what that does do for them is a lot of very fiscally responsible things. It not only helps the children reach their highest level of potential, it helps keep families together by reducing financial distress that they have. There's an exceptionally high divorce rate in families who have children with autism. It prevents bankruptcy. It helps families be less dependent on state funding. It also creates new jobs, which is also a happy thing in economies right now. With each one of these children requiring anywhere between 30 and 40 hours recommended a week, that's a new job for somebody. When we passed this bill in Louisiana, where I'm from, we worked very hard with the Department of Labor, and we are working with their workforce development to develop a training program for people who have lost their jobs, who have the skill sets to be able to work with these kids, to train them how to work with the kids so that we can create new jobs in Louisiana. It saves the state millions of dollars in special ed and potential housing and institutional costs, and it also helps return millions back to the state through sales taxes and property taxes, because if parents don't have to sell their home, they can continue to pay property taxes back to you to continue funding with the state. Autism is a very difficult thing, and when your child is diagnosed, it's like somebody walks in the room and they turn the light switch out all the way across the board. The doctors look at you and say, well, good luck, and they send you on your way. Your family members kind of scatter. It's totally different than when, for example, a child down the street is diagnosed with cancer, and everybody shows up with casseroles, and they hold fundraisers to help pay for that child's treatment. And when they come over to your house when your child's diagnosed with autism, and this is personal experience, your child is naked and jumping off the refrigerator and screaming at the top of his lungs, and your mother walks in and says, I really just don't know what to do with that, and turns around and walks back out the door. And these families need help, and these children can absolutely 100% get better. They can lead very normal and very independent and productive lives, and they deserve that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to run a little bit past our time, but I think we need to go to Catherine Commit at this point, and then we'll come back to the other testifiers before the day is over. But I think we need that. Well, Mr. Tran, why don't you go ahead? If you could be very quick, that'd be great.
Chair Keith and members of the committee, thank you. I recognize time. This will be quick. I talk fast, so buckle your seatbelt. Thank you so much for allowing me to be here. My name is Brad Trans from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm founder of a nonprofit with my wife on it to educate and bring advocacy about awareness. I'm also the current chair of the Minnesota Senate Resolution Task Force. We've been meeting up here since October 7th. biweekly. We're going to wrap up our report and present it to the governor, hopefully by on or before March 13th. We hope to have the House on board. More importantly, I'm the proud father of a son named Reese Tran, who has severe autism and now moderate mental retardation. Reese was diagnosed on January 23rd, 2003. It was a devastating blow, as by the Mayo Clinic and his physician stated that he needed 20 to 30 hours of ABA intense therapy. However, their self-insurance provider said, we're not going to cover it because it's educational and investigational. But through a three-party process of an appeal, we prevailed. Three psychiatric reviews said, no, this is not educational or investigational. It's the best-known therapy out there. I'm simply here to ask you to support House File 359, coverage for autism spectrum disorders. I echo the sentiments of our neighboring governor, Wisconsin's Governor Jim Doyle, who states, I hope the legislature in his state will work in a bipartisan way and side with the children and families with this disease and not with the big insurance companies. That's so important to take under advisement. For years, private insurance companies have failed our individuals diagnosed with autism. They have failed our moms and dads and guardians that care and love for them. They have failed the school districts and the teachers and the parents and therapy providers that bring such passion and hard work to them. They have failed you folks as legislators because they're going to put it on you to make the tough decisions on what should be covered and what should not be covered. And they have failed the taxpayers of our state and through our nation. Through the survey that we're conducting right now, a statewide survey that I've got in your handouts, 90% of our families have experienced moderate and a great deal of financial stress. 75% have had to reduce their workload moderately or a great deal. At the federal level, I would ask you to take a look at H.R. File H5028, the Fairness Autism Treatment Act. This legislation would ensure that autism is covered under a group health insurance plan at the same level that any physical illness is covered. Currently, 19 states, including Illinois and Iowa, cover autism treatment services. By passing this legislation, you will give our kids the hope that they deserve, the therapy that they deserve. We want to teach them vocational skills so someday when they get past that 21 years and in our public school system and whatnot, we can make them be taxpayers rather than depending upon taxpayers. You are looking at a child right there that has on the very first severe end of the spectrum where his insurance provider says, we give up on you. If he had a form of cancer, would they give up on him? No. Every child, every individual deserves a right to go to excel in their potential. That's what we're asking for. We're asking for a chance. We're asking for coverage. Just last week, on this nonverbal child in adaptive FIED, he stood on his leg for 14 seconds. Huge achievement. And guess what happened when his teacher said, Reese, do you want to try it again? He said no to a parent's delight. Someday, I can only hope that when we look at Reese in the eyes, he looks at Dad, Mom, and says, Dad, Mom, I love you. Thanks for fighting for me, and thanks for fighting for my peers. I thank you all for your public service to our state. I ask you for the support. 80% of our dads and moms out there and their marriage and divorce is costing taxpayers a lot of money, and it's now simply time that the private insurance industry be a player and help out and not be part of the problem. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for coming.
Ms. Commit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to comment today. My name is Catherine Commit. I'm with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, which is a trade group that represents Minnesota's 8 nonprofit health plans. And I want to state right up front that Minnesota's health plans all cover autism treatment for the commercial market. Because some self-funded employers vary their benefits from the health plan standard set of benefits, there may be some variations of coverage with some self-funded employers. And in your packet, I included a copy of two pie charts. I'm not going to go through them because of the time, but I want to remind everyone on the committee where Minnesotans get their health insurance coverage. And these two pie charts are snapshots in time, one from 1993, the other from 2005. These are the latest numbers that we have from the Department of Health. They have yet to update their coverage numbers. But what we show is that the fully insured market has shrunk considerably and now represents only 27% of the market. So this bill, when it goes into effect, will apply to 27% of the market, as you've heard some other testifiers mention. Coverage mandates are often sought with no quality assurance or documentation of value. They also fail to recognize the evolutionary nature of science and may require insurers to pay for services that are no longer the accepted community norm. Our members are dedicated to providing coverage that offers value-driven benefits. That means high-quality care in the most cost-effective manner that is consistent with the most up-to-date science. Given the tremendous personal and financial impacts of autism, we would want to apply the fullest interpretation of evidence-based care, and by that we mean scientific data to show which treatments are most cost-effective, clear diagnostic criteria and consistent application of this criteria, proper training of providers, and I want to stress that, and appropriate supervision of services, provider documentation of ongoing member benefits, and concurrent review of interventional behavioral therapy services. Now, Minnesota is in the middle of implementing the major healthcare reform legislation passed last session. The cornerstone of this reform is smarter use of our healthcare dollars to pay for treatment and services that provide value by demonstrating effectiveness and improving outcomes. The number of children diagnosed with autism and autism spectrum disorder is growing rapidly. We are sympathetic to the plight of parents and families who are desperate to find a treatment that can improve the life of their child. The quality of treatment varies, as does the cost. Again, the quality of treatment varies, as does the cost. Again, we believe there needs to be more focus and emphasis on establishing standards for quality so that these children and their families are getting the best care available to them. These are very, very expensive treatments, and they ought to be getting the very best care that, that the money can buy. As Representative Norton testified, we have been working with her on some amendment language. She has been very responsive and very reasonable to work with, and we look forward to continuing the discussion with her. And with that, I'll turn it over to Stacia.
Well, I just had a couple questions.
Sure.
So ABA therapy, is it the position of the health plans that it's not effective? Do the health plans recognize that it's effective and the intensive behavioral therapy is effective for some kids? Or are we disputing that?
Mr. Chair, I think there is some dispute about that. I think that not all the evidence is demonstrates how effective it is. And what we are saying, you know, with all due respect to meta-analyses, there just needs to be more data showing what works and how does it work, and then how can we do it in the most effective way. We're also concerned about making sure that it's delivered appropriately and that providers are delivering the care that is the best care.
And I guess my second question is, and I, you know, understand on the healthcare reform, obviously, where we're trying to go with that, but we're not there. And from what the Department of Health just told us last week, it's going to be even farther before we get there. It seems to me that for a lot of other things, you don't do this. You don't deny care because it's not evidence-based, and you don't deny care because it doesn't fall within certain parameters. So in the world we live in today, it just strikes me that we're setting autism up to a different standard than we set up all kinds of other stuff. And in an ideal world, we do get to a place where everyone's treated the same and we only perhaps pay for the best kind of care. And so I just like your reaction to that.
Mr. Chair and members, you are correct. There are not best practices or evidence-based science for every single thing that you can receive in a medical setting. That is changing, and more services and treatments are based on what the science tells physicians and others.
But do you deny care in those times?
Well, I'm not saying that the health plans deny care. I'm saying
I shouldn't say it as deny care, but do we not cover certain things that aren't where you have an evidence standard and then the provider doesn't meet the evidence standard? But you still cover those things.
Yes, Mr. Chair, you are correct. We still cover those things. Like I said, there are a lot of things for which the evidence is not readily available. This particular
this particular diagnosis is very difficult, and it's also very, very expensive. And so given that there's consensus that there is no cure for autism, that it's that the science doesn't show what the most effective treatments are, there are some studies, there is some evidence, but it's not, there is not agreement in the medical community that certain ABA treatments are what's most appropriate. There is disagreement in the medical community. And given that this rises to a higher threshold, perhaps, because the cost is so dramatic, up to $100,000 per child per year in some cases. So it's different than saying, well, I'm going to go to the doctor and get some antibiotics because I have a cold. This is a little bit different. The scope is bigger. The scale is different.
And that's helpful. I think that's a little bit different argument. So that's helpful. Thank you. Why don't you complete your testimony, and then you both, and Mr. Hickey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stacey Smith, and I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Just real quick, the Chamber is the state's largest business advocacy organization in the state. We represent over 2,700 members, 80% of which are small employers, meaning they have fewer than 100 employees. And the Chamber supports policy changes that reduce the impact of healthcare mandates, taxes, and regulations on the cost of healthcare. We oppose House File 359 because it expands government healthcare mandates that fall disproportionately on the fully insured market, increasing costs for mainly small and medium-sized businesses. We urge this committee to focus on reforms that will help make healthcare more affordable and not to increase mandates and regulations that will drive up costs. Our concern is about mandates generally, not limited to the autism mandate. I'm very sympathetic to this issue. However, Minnesota does impose more mandates and regulation on healthcare coverage and services than almost any other state already. Many small and medium-sized employers are struggling right now to offer healthcare insurance due to the rising cost of premiums. These costs are due in part to the mandates and government regulations that we put on them. Rising premiums and even, like I said, raising premiums by just even a small amount could be a tipping point for many employers to stop offering health care to employees. I also want to encourage the chair to use statute 60J.26, which states that the chair of any standing committee that has jurisdiction over the subject matter, this one being autism, has the jurisdiction to request that the commissioner complete an evaluation of the proposal. This is a review process that the legislature adopted in 2006 to look at the costs and benefits of mandates. This is important that the legislature receives a balanced review of the costs, benefits, and medical evidence prior to enactment of the bill. We're talking back and forth about what proof we have and whatnot. I think this would be a good process to go through to fully understand.
And just so everybody knows, we have made contact with the Department of Commerce, and I'm not sure they're actually the most effective people to analyze the health impact of this treatment. They're insurance people, they're not health people.
Right. With that, I just want to say thank you to Representative Norton for listening to the Chamber's concerns and also to the committee.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the state's largest business group in terms of entities. The Chamber certainly represents more employees. We represent 13,000 businesses, small businesses across the state, and have a significant member base in every one of your districts. And I don't represent insurance companies here. I'm representing small employers that are having trouble making their premiums this year and wondering if they're going to continue to offer health insurance, and also are the source of a lot of uninsurance in the private sector. Most of the uninsurance in the private sector falls under companies less than 10, where the business just literally can't buy health insurance. So as compelling as this issue is, they're really not worried about that because they can't even provide a basic health plan for their employees. I was just absolutely startled. I've been around this issue for a long time, and I know some of you have also. I was just startled by this 27% number. We have reached the point where this bill is going to reach 27%. I remember coming in and having discussion on mandates when it was 40, 50%. This should be alarming to every one of you. This should give you pause. This should give you second and third thought about doing anything in this area again that's going to have any kind of serious cost impact. And I think that this committee certainly showed that there is going to be serious cost impact. Are we going to be talking about this one? It's impacting, are we going to hear some other year when it affects 15% of the market? How much flight to ERISA, uninsurance, and piling on to small business do we need to do for people to realize this is a broken model? This doesn't work. And I'm just shocked by the 27% number. I had no idea it gotten that low. I've heard a lot of estimates in the last couple of years in the 30 to 40% range. Another point you really need to keep in mind is that Minnesota has dropped autism coverage from the state Medicaid program due to concern over costs. And if there's concern over costs there, how about the small employers that don't even know if they can make their premiums any longer? And how about the ones that have dropped coverage and are part of that that uninsurance rate in the private sector? Wisconsin, as you know, is considering this proposal. The estimate is it's going to cost $7.4 million to $8.7 million annually just for their state employees. Well, extrapolate that over hundreds of thousands of small businesses in this state, and what's the cost going to be? I think what this really shows is that we've had some discussion, and Stacey just brought it up, but we do need a mandatory benefit analysis system, and I mean mandatory, and at worst, it might hold up a mandate one session for something to get completely done because you need to do a good analysis. But we just need to have different experts weigh in, have a process, and then have a hearing, have a lot of numbers in front of us versus what we're doing today. We know this is expensive. I guess we don't have a concise estimate. I know Representative Norton's trying to mitigate the cost impact, and we appreciate her doing that. But you're affecting 27% of the people. You don't know really what the cost is. You know there's a real problem with uninsurance in the small employer sector. You know that if the economy gets worse, the rate of the uninsured is going to go up, but still, we're going to go ahead and do this. I'd urge you to lay this over and to we need more analysis on this, especially anything that is expensive in the category of mandates, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Representative Bunn and then Loeffler. And we don't have much time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to put some informational requests on the table, and it looks like they won't be resolved in today's hearing, but I know this bill will go through several committees. First of all, in terms of Ms. Kemet, you don't have to answer this, but just in terms of plans, I'd like to see, for future reference before this gets to the end of the process this session, exactly what coverage is offered by the eight plans and whether it's offered in both their self-insured administration and also in their the full insured market. Secondly, I'd like to hear about training certification for you thought that there was some quality control issues. I'd like to hear from the advocates exactly in terms of ABA. We heard about programs at the University of Minnesota and things like that, so it sounds like this training is going on. So exactly what are the quality concerns from the insurance sector? Secondly, how are those being addressed in the market currently? What kinds of programs, what kind of certification, what kind of qualifications do they have, all the providers of this care? And third, in terms of the pie chart, I'm not sure what it tells us, because we've learned today here the private self-insured portion at the University of Minnesota, they're self-insured, but they're providing this benefit because they decided to. This bill wouldn't affect them in any way, as far as I can tell, and they could probably decide next week to uninsure this benefit, and it wouldn't be affected by the bill. So I don't know to what extent and how and whether it covers ABA for MA or for Minnesota Care. I don't know if state employees are fully covered and it includes ABA. You know, those are all questions that I think the legislature in general would want to have addressed before this completes the process this session. Again, I'm very, I do think families with autism need coverage. I also am very concerned about proceeding along with mandates without full analysis, which is why I support mandate analysis generally as well, that we don't have a good system in place, and it's been that who would cover such the cost of analysis has been a sticking point. So anyways, I commend you for the working on this this issue, but I do think we need many of those questions addressed as we move forward this session and the other committees.
And Representative Norton, just a quick question. So under current insurance law, setting aside kind of the distinction, this is a really expensive thing. And when we've had some lawsuits, they've been resolved. It sounds like the appeals have been resolved in favor of the families with autism under current. One of the things Ms. Dawson said right at the beginning of her testimony was that we really don't need this bill because current law covers it. Now, whether we should go to an evidence-based benefit set is another question. But the way we deal with these things today, this stuff should be covered already, is kind of my sense of things. Would that be accurate? And so we're really not adding a mandate. It's kind of, I think that unless, except we're adding a mandate on families that they have to sue to get coverage.
That's a nice assessment, yeah. The assumption would be that insurance companies should currently be covering this and sometimes claim they do cover this, but the reality for families is there's very haphazard approval of coverage, and so we're
we're bringing this bill forward, as have the other 11 to 19 states. I heard, you know, maybe 19 is more updated a number, because of this haphazard application, and we're trying to level the playing field and make it clear in law.
President Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, I wanted to respond to Mr. Hickey and remind him that the business cost is not just on the health insurance side. If a third of these children are being mainstreamed, the impact of keeping those children in the mainstream classroom out of special ed on property taxes, other state revenues, other lifelong dependency costs, I think should be factored into the economic impact on our communities. So I just thought that we need to look at the big picture as well as the particular industry.
Yes, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Chairman. I just have one really brief question for the author. Following up on Representative Dunn's question a while ago about... it sounds like there's both home care options and center care options for families who are looking for the ABA therapy. Is it strictly up to them? They just choose, and is the center care, they're able to drop their child off for the amount of hours that day and pick them back up, or what's the difference? I'm just curious.
Maybe more appropriate, Mr. Chair, to ask some of the families that participate. What I have witnessed myself is that sometimes it's both. There's a center in Rochester, I know, and Fraser Clinic has many opportunities up here in the Twin Cities area where families will send their child and get treatment, but they also have home treatment and parental involvement so that parents can help supplement and the schools involved. So, again, for that very early age, it is very intensive and multiple sites might be involved. And I don't know if Ms. Dawson has something to say.
20 seconds, if we could.
What I tell the hundreds of parents who ask me about how to find out who to go to is first figure out what will your insurance cover. And if you have to rely on MA, which does cover ABA therapy, then make sure they take MA. And then ask them for their outcome data.
Okay. Thank you, everybody, and for your indulgence today. Representative Norton is going to renew her motion that House File 359 be recommended passing referred to Commerce and Labor Committee, where a lot of these insurance issues actually are more appropriately addressed. I think the health care issue is really, and whether this is a real condition or not that can be treated, I think, is the issue before this health committee. So, all in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. And thank you, everybody. We are adjourned.